Here Be Monsters is a show that invites you to explore fear and the unknown.
I saw her face change. I saw her see where I'd pulled my hair out.
Psychological warfare was always considered kind of an oddity, something done by freaks.
On the count of three, we're literally going to step out of our body. Step out.
You can find the new season of Here Be Monsters on August 17th at kcrw.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA. Today we're going to talk about the politics of public swimming pools as we visit a gorgeous newly restored pool in South LA. And the streets are alive with art.
Things like Current LA have brought attention to the idea of doing works that create, I think, a physical common ground in a city where people often accuse us of existing in nothing but our cars.
We'll talk about how private murals and public installations are turning the outdoors into a gallery. Before we get to that, though...
In between them is Manuel of the USA. She's the threat at the moment. There's quite a few lining up now. This is not clear-cut at all. And it's going to be Manuel in lane three.
American swimmer Simone Manuel broke the world record in the women's 100-meter freestyle at the Rio Olympics last week, tying for first place. But her win represented another barrier smashed.
Yeah, it means a lot. I mean, this medal is not just for me. It's for a whole bunch of people who have came before me and have been inspiration to me. Maritza Cullen, and it's for all the people after me who believe they can't do it. And I just want to be inspiration to others that you can do it.
That was Simone Manuel, and she was referring to the shoulders she stands on, two Black Olympic swimmers, Maritza Correa and Cullen Jones.
Stigmas have been broken, stereotypes have been dissolved. It's an international effect that she's had.
That's Miriam Lynch. She's director of diversity in aquatics. Manuel is the first African-American woman to win Olympic gold in a sport, aquatics, that has a sorry history of exclusion. A recent study sponsored by USA Swimming found that 70% of Black teenagers and 60% of Latino teenagers cannot swim. And that disparity can mean death, literally. According to the US Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, African-American kids age 11 to 12 drown at rates 10 times those of white children. Why this disparity? Well, 19th century public pools mixed races but not the sexes. Then Jim Crow and the advent of tighter swimsuits put pools off limits to African Americans, either by law in the South or by brute force in the North. Here's Jeff Wiltsey, author of Contested Waters, A Social History of Swimming Pools in America, talking to NPR a few years back.
Most whites in the northern United States did not want Black men interacting with white women at such visually and physically intimate public spaces as a swimming pool. And this became more pronounced during the 1920s and 1930s as the acceptable size of swimsuits shrank.
Being kept from public pools gave rise to a fear of swimming, says Sean Anderson, who's co-founder of Diversity in Aquatics. And that's because often the only waters available were...
open bodies of water that were extremely dangerous at one time, which I think adds to the African-American parents and families discouraging kids from going swimming. If the only place you were allowed to go swim was treacherous, then a good solution is not to go swimming.
Then desegregation coincided with the rise of another barrier. Back to Jeff Wiltsey.
In the early 20th century, especially during the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, pools were a very high public priority. Right now, they're not. And so most people who want to gain access to swimming pools have to gain access to private pools. And so that clearly works to the advantage or enables middle and upper class Americans.
One person in LA who's been working to change this picture is Conrad Cooper. He's also known as the Swim Whisperer. He gives private swimming lessons at his home in View Park. That's a predominantly African-American affluent neighborhood in the Baldwin Hills area.
I swam as a youngster, competed, and the hurdles are huge, and primarily because we don't have access to pools like most folks do. Inner city pools are sorely needed. And most of them are not used for actually swimming, but just kind of playing and lollygagging.
Now you, Conrad Cooper, have made it your life's mission to educate young Black kids in swimming. Was it that childhood experience of yours that inspired you to do that?
No, actually not. But it was my motivation after I started doing it to keep on doing what I was doing. I heard throughout my entire lifetime that, you know, we don't swim. you know, black folks don't swim. It's something that African Americans are not, you know, accustomed to. And I was raised in a neighborhood that was filled with neighborhood pools, so I didn't know anything but that as a child, but to swim. So for me, it was really the business of teaching our community kids to swim more than the fact I was trying to waylay Miss. Although once I got started, it was a big motivation for me as well to do that also.
So how is the story in L.A.? That's the sound of kids splashing and lollygagging at Central Recreation Center pool.
My name is Melanie.
Tell me your reaction to this swimming pool.
I really like it, actually. It's very fun, and I like how there's two sides, and then the middle's deep, and yeah, it's really fun to come here.
Can you tell me your name?
Don Ancin.
So here you are at the pool. Is this your first time at the pool?
No, I come here every Saturdays and Sundays.
Do you live in the neighborhood?
I live kind of far, but I still come here because it's really nice.
Did you have a pool to go to before the arrival of this one?
No.
This pool is on East 22nd Street between Washington and Adams in a neighborhood south of the 10 freeway that is now majority Latino and African American. The pool replaces one damaged in the Northridge earthquake, and it opened this summer after being closed for 12 years. The city also opened another new swimming pool, this one at 109th Street, south of Watts. At the pool, we also met up with its architect. He's called Michael Lehrer, and Central is one of three pool projects his firm has done for the city.
The idea was to create a wonderful outdoor room. So the nature of the spaces around it here, we're sitting on one of several dozen built-in benches that are places to lie down, sit down, put your clothes, and when no one's using them, just a place to remind you that this is a place for people.
And it's under a white lattice. You've got some very cheerful colours, turquoise, a kind of greenish-yellow. You've also built these structures that
yes.
Give the place a kind of a definition.
I mean, our first preoccupation is architecture is light and space. And in terms of light, it's about light and its shadow. And we have this this notion that somehow when you see light and shadow dancing together, it's a happy circumstance.
Especially when they're dancing together off of water.
That's right, absolutely. So the play of dappled light and sort of our, you know, our aqua pool colors, I mean, sort of the quintessence of Southern California pool joy.
You've talked about the notion of a public swimming pool being part of the mindscape
yeah.
of a community. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, wherever you live, you know, you think of your street, your church, your school, the stores you go to, whatever. They're embedded in your mind as this is my home. Each of us have our own sort of mindscape of our neighborhood, our cities, places that we feel special going to. I grew up in East Hollywood in Los Feliz, and I remember as a child in the 50s, our neighborhood swimming pool, public swimming pool, across from the Mulholland Fountain at Los Feliz and Riverside was just part of like, oh, this is my community. There is a pool that belongs to me in my community, and that's embedded in my brain. And you think not only more affectionately about it, but you know, it's the beginning of this virtuous cycle of improvement when your neighborhood has things that you value and you think, oh, my neighborhood is good, it becomes better.
But what's important about the swimming pool in this mindscape, as you've laid it out, is that there's been a sorry history of inequity in access to swimming pools. Every neighborhood has had its churches, but not every neighborhood has had its swimming pools.
Well, I think that's right. And I mean, particularly in Southern California, particularly in Los Angeles, and particularly in a marvelous climate, but where the summers, you know, are the hot season. And in lieu of having a pool in your neighborhood, it is an unmitigated, hot, and often challenging season. With a pool in your neighborhood, it is not only mitigated, but it's fantastic. It's one of life's simple pleasures, a sense of easy luxury that belongs to everybody. Well, I mean, I think, / hope, that we are coming out of a generation or two or three where we have not tended to the public well-being and the kinds of places that are essential, the kind of infrastructure of well-being that just makes you happy to be part of the community. Not having this is corrosive.
That was architect Michael Lehrer. Now, Central Pool is really quite lovely, but the folks at Diversity and Aquatics still have some questions. Here's Virgil Chauncey, who's a member of Diversity and Aquatics, and Miriam Lynch.
Let's talk about it. 3 years from now, they still don't have the backing. You have, what is that, Martin Luther King Pool over there? It's also for L.A. They're struggling every year to get the funds to keep their swim team as well as water safety programs. So long as the backing continues, it'll be excellent.
It also takes the community to vote on what's important for that community so it lasts not just, you know, with the hype of the Olympics, but it goes, like Virgil said, 3 years from now, 10 years from now, and further down the line.
Certainly, Central Pool was designed with durable and easy-to-maintain materials, but it is not a competition-sized pool, and nor is it open year-round. So to get answers to the questions raised by Chauncey and Lynch, we turn to Michael Scholl. He's general manager for the City of Los Angeles Department of Recreation and Parks, which runs 60 pools. Over recent decades, many had fallen into disrepair or were barely open. Among them, the pool referred to by Virgil Chauncey, that's the Celez King III pool in Rancho Cienega Park in the Baldwin Hills area. But then along came HELP, funds for upgrading facilities from Propositions A and K, grants for free swim lessons for adults and children from Kaiser Permanente and LA 84, the foundation for youth sports founded after the 1984 Olympics.
The good news is, you know, we're kind of through this, you know, horrible 10 years, you know, of economic crisis, and we're actually in a pretty strong rebuilding stage in the Parks Department right now. So additional maintenance and things like that are now not really as big of an issue as they were. And plus, we're designing our pools much smarter. And when I mean smarter, technology smarter. You know, for example, the technology that we put in our new pools allows our maintenance staff to actually communicate with the pool equipment via their cell phone. On the programming side of things, the swim lessons are absolutely essential. And we do have pools built to competitive standards so that, you know, we do a lot of joint use with LUSD and schools and things like that. And then most of these pools are open seasonally. However, we're designing them now to be operational year-round. It's a much different model than a seasonal pool.
Is it fair to say that there was a bit of a lull in pool construction and maintenance and the access was kind of diminishing, but now it's building back up again?
Finding capital money, you know, inside of any park agencies is always a challenge. We've had a high priority on swimming pools for a number of years. Practically, at least in the South LA area, every swimming pool will be brand new. I mean, that disparity won't exist anymore. We did two this year. We've got another two in design. We're building a new swimming pool, indoor swimming pool facility at Rancho Cienega.
Near Baldwin Hills.
Very near Baldwin Hills. That facility is going to be amazing. I mean, we've been working on this for years. It does take a lot of years to get the funding in place. And the funding sources usually come from, I mean, I've built swimming pools that had as many as 10 different funding sources.
And lastly, back to Simone. Could LA produce a Simone Manuel? I think I know the answer, but I want to hear it from you.
Yeah, I do think that. I mean, I do. And it is simply about access and opportunity.
Finally, does all this make you want to swim, but maybe you haven't yet learned? Patricia Delgado runs the aquatic program for the City of LA, and she gave us this response.
Last year, we taught a person who is 82 years old, and that was one of her life goals, was to learn to swim. You're never too old to learn to swim.
And do you have a favorite public pool in LA? Let us know on DNA's Facebook page. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Check out images of Central Pool and other City of LA pools newly completed or under construction on our website. Coming up after this break, it's been a bumper summer for public art. Why? And will it last?
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Subscribe to KCRW's Today's Top Tune download podcast to receive a free song of the day and find today's top tune on KCRW's iTunes page.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. We've been hearing two things about Los Angeles in recent years. It's fast becoming an art capital, and it's embracing public space with new parks, public transit, and a reclaimed river, and much more. But are the two connected? Because if you drive, walk, or take the train right now, you will see a lot of art. The list includes the following. The recent Current LA Water, that was a public art biennial that put conceptual art installations relating to the theme of water in far-flung corners of the city. Also, there was Liquid Shard, that was the floaty, tinsely wing suspended over Pershing Square by an artist named Patrick Schoen that drew crowds to the unloved park, but sadly had to come down late last week. Then there are artworks at each station on the new Gold Line and Expo Line extensions. Then there's a bumper crop of new murals. Now, some of this work is commissioned and funded by the city or by Metro, some by building owners. Other pieces are self-funded by artists. But the aggregate is a lot of stuff to see outside, beyond those Pokemon Go characters. So why all this art outside, and what should you go see? We turned to five people who think about this kind of thing, and we invited them to meet us in Pershing Square on the last day that Liquid Shard was up.
I'm Carolina Miranda, staff writer for the LA Times. I mean, I think there is definitely renewed attention to public art as Los Angeles thinks about issues of public space. Things like Current LA have brought attention to the idea of doing works that create, I think, a physical common ground in a city where people often accuse us of existing in nothing but our cars. So is it an explosion? I don't know. It's hard to have an explosion of any kind in a city as big as Los Angeles and have it be felt anywhere. But I do think it's an interesting moment in which people are thinking about dialoguing with these spaces.
Hi, I'm Catherine Wagley. I write about art for the LA Weekly and Art News. It seems like the growth is also correlated with like the opening of the Broad or the growth of the gallery scene in the Arts District and conversations about gentrification and how art relates to those things. I haven't totally figured it out, but that's what I'm thinking about.
Hi, I'm Lizzie Dastin. I am an art history professor. I think as an offshoot of the surgence of the gallery scene and also the public art space is the street art world and graffiti. And in the last few years, I have definitely seen a multiplicity of really significant voices within that kind of placemaking. But LA has had a formidable history with public art since the 1940s. So I think that it's just in line with a trajectory that's already firmly established.
This is Matt Stromberg. I'm a freelance arts writer here in LA. In a broader sense, we're rethinking what public spaces mean in LA. We don't have great squares here, we don't have great meeting places, but we do have a lot of public space. You know, it's a moment where we're rethinking how to use that space. Grand Park, I think, is a great example of a really successful public area. And here we're sitting in Pershing Square, which is kind of one of the most maligned public spaces. And it, you know, it seemed like it was ripe for somebody to come in and actually make it attractive.
So I'm Shayna Neese-Dambrod. I'm an art critic and curator. You can't just say public art anymore, because there was a time when that meant one thing. It meant giant sculptures outside of banks, and that was what public art was. But now people are going back and redefining what public art sort of is, and it being temporary is one thing that's sort of loosening to be able to put things up that, because they're not going to last as long, don't have to strictly adhere to certain sort of building codes. And so on the one hand, that should be more exciting, but it often ends up with these sort of half projects. Often those projects wind up being seen by so very few.
The next question is going to be, if you were going to take a friend, a family member to see some art, and you had one afternoon,
Would you take them to a gallery, a museum, or would you take them to an outside exhibit of some sort?
I think that would depend on how hot it is. I think there's something to be said for air-conditioned museum galleries. But, you know, being totally serious, obviously it depends on personal taste. There's a pretty terrific Agnes Martin exhibit at LACMA right now, which I have been taking a lot of people to. But I do think it has been an interesting time with current LA to get outdoors. I think one of the most remarkable pieces that has emerged out of that project is a sculpture by the Mexican artist Teresa Margolis in Echo Park called La Sombra, which means the shade. And it's this giant brutalist concrete shelter that she made with water that was used to wash sites where homicides had taken place around Los Angeles. So it's this very sort of symbolic shelter, this idea that we shelter ourselves with the spirits of the dead. It's also this very large and magnetic installation. And I think that when you maybe just want to pop in to see something rather than spend 3 hours dwelling on a show, I think seeing those kinds of things can be really interesting and rewarding and something that you can do on the way somewhere rather than a destination in and of themselves.
This is Matt Stromberg. I would highly recommend the new Hauser, Wirth & Schimmel complex. Doesn't need any more publicity or press, but I think it's a great combination of institutional art world exhibition of 20th century female sculptors that's really top-notch, museum quality, but also a great public space, internal courtyard, the restaurant, there's a great bookstore, so it really is kind of a combination of those two things. I would also recommend an old standby, which is Watts Towers. It's kind of the anti-plop piece of art, right? It's one guy's vision, and it's been rescued a number of times from the threat of it being torn down. And it's also spawned the Watts Towers Art Complex, which is a great focal point for the assemblage art movement. Noah Purifoy, John Outer Bridge were connected to that. So it's kind of a piece of public art that is part of the community.
Hi, Lizzie Dastin. I would absolutely take anyone visiting on a street art tour, graffiti art tour, walk around either the downtown arts district to talk about murals that are sanctioned or self-sanctioned, stencils, wheat paste, the variety of media that you see popping up every day. I think that there are some really exciting voices artistically manifesting right now. I think that muralists like Christina Angelina or graffiti street artists like Thrashbird, Colette Miller, who does those beautiful angel wings, or someone who's a little bit more non-objective like Michael Branrup. And all of these people, even though they physically are showing outside of a traditional institutional space of a museum or gallery, I think that the content and the purpose and the anarchy and the spirit is just as significant.
This is Shayna Anise Dambrot. One of my most recent favorite public art initiatives is the robustness of the current Metro Arts program. Two things I love about it, which is that there's trains now. People who don't drive or don't feel like dealing with that actually have a true alternative way to explore other parts of the city. And that along the way, they've really married it with the work of contemporary visual artists. And so it's not just the wonderment of being able to take the train to the beach, it's along the way, leaning out every single window, being able to see a really diverse selection of the work of contemporary visual artists at each station.
It so happens we met one of the artists Metro commissioned to create work for the Expo Line extension. Judith Hernandez is one of the more prominent public artists in LA, having been involved in Chicano art and political activism since the 1970s. We talked at the Santa Monica Terminus stop in front of her series of glass mosaic panels entitled LA Sonata.
So I decided to take every iconic cultural image I could find that was appropriate and weave them into a tapestry of Los Angeles, the diversity that is here, the remarkable diversity that is here. And it follows a pattern of musical forms that you find in symphonic music, only this time they're in imagery, that follow the passing of the day and the passing of the seasons.
But overlaid on that seasonal passage of time story is the mythologies of the cultures that you're representing.
Absolutely. I often plugged in classical iconography to stand in for most of Europe, like from the Greeks and the Romans. But there are some that show the rolling hills of the British Isles, tulips from Holland, Korean, Japanese, Chinese, Mexican, every kind of, you know, symbol that I thought was so iconic of that particular group of people, you know, who live here in great numbers, that those people will recognize it. And tourists, I mean, that was the other thing I had to think about. That station will not only have lots of people, you know, from the local area using it on a daily basis, but there were people from all over the world who come to Santa Monica because it's a destination point. It's got the beach and, you know, all of that lovely stuff at, you know, near the ocean.
You've had a background, an interesting background in activism. Does that, yeah. Do you bring that to bear?
It was a long time ago in the sense of the verb active.
We asked Judith about public art then, when she was active in the 1970s, and now in Los Angeles.
I think there's certainly a renaissance. It's different. The work that I see is definitely more decorative and less issue-centered than it was back in the 70s, and probably for good reason. It was the 1970s, you guys are too young to remember, was a period of tremendous social upheaval. The women's movement, the you know, Black Panthers, the Brown Berets, the Chicano civil rights movement, gay rights, Vietnam. I mean, there were just a million things to talk about in murals. And now there is a trend to do large art, but it doesn't seem to be as socially focused as ours was. I think it's very handsome. I'm not sure that it moves me emotionally the way, you know, art from the 70s did, but I mean, every generation has to find its way in public art. And I think as, you know, issues change over time, that those things always come back again. Something, unfortunately, awful will happen, or there'll be some controversy, and you'll see artists beginning to talk about those things.
That was Judith Hernandez. So we went back to our art panel in Pershing Square for a response.
Lizzie Dastin here. I think that there is such diversity of content with regards to street and mural art that it may not be particularly fair to say that work that's put up now is not politicized. But a recent example is that wonderful piece that Plastic Jesus did in Hollywood, where he constructed the 6-inch wall around Donald Trump's star. And that received a viral amount of attention. And I think that that is one among countless examples of street artists who are still infusing their work with some kind of activism.
It's Shana Nice Dambrot here. I think, too, that, you know, there's a certain degree to which reclaiming neglected public space has already a political aspect to it, just going, this is my city, too. I'm painting on this wall. Come and stop me.
This is Carolina Miranda. I think there is something to what Judith is saying, and that, you know, Judith came out of a tradition of Chicano muralism in the 1970s, working with Los Four, where a lot of muralism, you know, it wasn't being commissioned by commercial entities. It was really about Chicano identity, about police abuses, about problems related to education, about things like gentrification, the walkouts, the Vietnam War. I mean, they were really dealing with a lot of very heady topics in some of their murals, some of which you can still go see in you know, the Estrada Courts in Boyle Heights, Ramona Gardens. And what you are seeing now is not necessarily that those topics are absent on the part of the artist, but you see, you know, things like real estate companies adopting, you know, sort of co-opting the idea of the commissioned graffiti mural to make maybe the side of a condo building look edgy and cool. So I don't think she's completely wrong in saying that you know, that a lot of artists are not dealing with political art. But I think, again, that comes to the idea of who has commissioned this art and why.
You heard from Carolina Miranda, Matt Stromberg, Catherine Wagley, Lizzie Dastin, and Shana Nice Dambrot. Check our website for more on the locations of the pieces that they discussed. I'm Frances Anderton, and that's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Special thanks to Jason Groman and Stephanie Case. Thank you very much for listening. Stay tuned for The World, coming up next.